First, let's start on Tropical Storm Ida, which slammed Louisiana and key oil assets on Sunday at Category 4 status. Joining us now is Dan Dicker, the Energy Word founder. Dan, always good to speak with you here. Talk to us a little bit why we're not seeing a bigger reaction in the oil and gas markets here.
Well, first of all, Brian, I think the oil guys have gotten really good about dealing with these storms, especially since Katrina, the big storm that really knocked out supply both in the Gulf of Mexico and also the distribution from the Gulf Coast refineries afterwards. And since then, they've just done a tremendous job. And basically, these storms keep getting more frequent and more ferocious, and yet they get better and better prepared for them. So in the Gulf of Mexico, that 1.75 million barrels that came offline, when the wind goes under 25 knots, they're right back taking the covers off and they'll be back in production in 18 hours. The refineries will be a little bit longer. I mean, those take a little while to ramp up. So I think we're going to see some higher gas prices, particularly in the southern areas of the country. That might last a month or so. There's never a storm that happens where the refinery guys and the pipeline guys don't use it as an opportunity to catch a little break in terms of better rack prices at the pumps.
Well, Dan, let's talk then about sort of what we've seen in the energy market and the gas market. You had the Colonial Pipeline. What was that, 3-4 months ago at this point? That was a catalyst for some higher gas prices. Talk about this as a potential catalyst for higher gas prices. What is the setup today in the oil markets? Crude right around 70. I think, it's now been, 18 months since the negative 40 print. I mean, where is the market going from here? Have we found stabilization, let's say, in that 60 to 70 range? Or do you think, it's likely higher for oil prices and then in turn gas prices?
I mean, this storm is very much a bump in the road. The two big things we're looking at are very obvious. First, of course, the pandemic Delta and how bad that's going to get in terms of shutdowns and then, growth problems and the same kinds of things we saw, 8 months ago with the original virus. So we're always watching that. We're watching the rates of infection and the death numbers and how that's going to play out in those anti-vaccination states, for lack of a better word. The second thing, of course, is OPEC themselves, who has taken the opportunity of higher oil prices to put together, an increase in production. That's managed to scuttle prices a bit. I mean, we had a drop of close to $12. It's rallied back about $5. A lot of that has been part of a technical bounce as well as this storm. It has made a difference in terms of oil prices going back to around 66 and change and so on. But right now what we're going to look at, particularly with this OPEC meeting coming up on Wednesday, is whether they will stick to that increase in production. Generally, you get the OPEC guys tend to turn chicken when they see oil prices go up and up, which they feel they can get greedy and start to increase production again. Oil prices tend to settle down, and then you wonder whether they're going to get frightened by that settling and renege on the increases in production that they've just recently put into place. My guess is that they won't. They'll have this increase in production, and we're going to resume this kind of flattening of the curve and flattening of oil prices that we started to see towards the beginning of July, actually, and has been running through a large part of August. And I think we're going to see prices again moderate back towards that $60 area until we get further clarity, one, on what OPEC is going to ultimately do, and, of course, in the way that, this pandemic is going to play out in terms of how it's going to affect the global economy. And, I don't see it being a very good trajectory right now.
Dan, someone just handed me a good note out of Goldman Sachs moments ago on the oil market. They're noting, just going back to the storm, they're noting that Valero and ExxonMobil could eventually see a delayed impact to their operations as, I guess, damage is assessed here. Would you agree with that, that these downstream companies are most exposed? And do you think there's an earnings risk here because of the storm to those companies?
This is one of those trader plays as opposed to fundamental plays. So Goldman is right. The downstream is going to have an issue in this quarter from the storm. They always do. It's small. It's something that can be moderated and so on. But the trade has always been to buy these refiners right before the storms sort of gin up in the Gulf. And for Valero, particularly because it is a, you know, the premier Gulf Coast refiner, it's had a 12% move up, you know, over the last four or five sessions. So the question is whether the fundamentals start to impact what now that the storm is dissipating and going north. And my guess is that, yes, you've seen a very, very nice run in Valero, which got under 60 bucks and is now, you know, in the mid 60s, 66 and a half or so. And it would be a time if you had that trade, which, by the way, some of my subscribers did. I gave it to them as an old school kind of storm refinery trade, that this would be a great moment to cash in on some short term profits in those refinery stocks.
Dan Dicker, the Energy Word founder. Always good to see you. Stay safe, sir.
Ah, thanks, Brian. Thanks. Nice to see you, too.
Many in the buy now, pay later space are seeing a stock price boost following a firm's new deal with Amazon. One of those names is Marqeta, with shares up about 7% so far in today's session. Unlike others, though, Marqeta actually does business with the firm. Joining us now for more is Marqeta founder and CEO Jason Gardner. Jason, good to see you this morning here. So as I mentioned, you in fact do business with a firm. What do you do with them, and how does this Amazon deal that they struck, how does this impact you?
Well, we're very happy to power a firm in their buy now, pay later solution. So what we do is we help companies like Amazon, Klarna, Zip, Afterpay, basically connect to the point of sale. So think of us as like the last mile. We call it a server-to-server virtual card. So when you're a consumer and you want to buy now, pay later with a firm or others, it generates a 16-digit card. And that card could be Visa or MasterCard. It's then inserted into the checkout flow, which makes it very easy for the buy now, pay later companies to set up with merchants. And really allow them to, sign up and move pretty quickly in regards to options for consumers.
And Jason, I was talking to some folks this morning on just, you know, how much of a financial impact this will have on a firm. But by extension, it has to have a financial impact on your business as well, no?
Well, we're very proud to power a firm, helping them, you know, really they're penetrating the largest e-commerce company in the world. We power a number of solutions for a firm, Klarna, Afterpay, Zip, as we talked about. And we don't go specifically into how we power them which merchants we power them with. But we're excited to have them as a customer.
You know, so Jason, you talk about, you know, being this last mile connection of a sort between online transactions. I'm curious, and I think this is a question that people generally have about this new payment method, whether it is BNPL, whether it's just an in-house, you know, credit solution for a certain merchant, so on and so forth. Are you guys taking on any of the credit risk in that, or are you helping to just facilitate, you know, the transaction between the two parties? How do you fit into that?
Yeah, so we don't take on any credit risk. We're really just facilitating the two parties working together. And buy now, pay later is 40% of Americans used this method last year. If you look at Europe, it was a European phenomenon. Companies like Klarna invented this and then came to the United States. Think of it as like reverse layaway. So the way layaway had worked is, you know, the good, what you're looking to buy sits at the merchant. And then when you pay it off, you receive it. Now we've reversed that with buy now, pay later. We're getting the product or the good in advance, and then you're paying it off over time. Now, consumers have to pay their bills. That credit is provided by a firm. And again, we're just facilitating the two parties and making sure that they can, streamline the checkout method.
Now, Jason, you guys, you had your results about 3 weeks ago. You came public via an IPO this year. I'm just curious, you know, what that process was like with this environment. You know, we're talking about, companies, different industry, but a company earlier today announcing a fundraise of valuation 3x what it was 6 months ago. You know, there's a lot of appetite for new businesses, and certainly you've had interactions with the street over the last several months. What has that process been like for you guys trying to balance both the fundamental growth of your business, but certainly the investor enthusiasm for companies in your space and new companies generally?
Yeah, so when we started the company back in 2010, I mean, fintech or financial technologies wasn't even a thing. I mean, nobody was really talking about it. And companies like Marqeta that built an open platform for companies to build payment cards, whether Visa or MasterCard cards. And we found that our technology allowed companies to, you know, disrupt entire industries or solve enormous problems at scale. So companies like Instacart, when their shopper goes into the store, they swipe that card to pick up your groceries. We get the message from the point of sale. We deliver that to Instacart. And Instacart basically goes through that message. You know, is the shopper on shift, or in the right merchant at the right time? Is it a right amount based on the basket size? And then they tell us to authorize the transaction on their behalf. So we do that millions of times a day. We allow these companies to scale pretty significantly. This technology called issuing and processing is very deceptively complex. And we see this within the financial technology space. We decided 18 months ago we wanted to become a public company. This was very much a personal decision for me as the founder and CEO. And then, you know, really 6 months before you go public, you know, you get really deep into the process. And it was a great journey. We're really happy to be a public company. We felt like this was the next step in our journey. And now we're finding, I mean, wow, the amount of venture capital that is really flowing into these companies at massive valuations, I think it shows that we're in the very early innings in regards to the opportunity, not only within the space, but really the world is going, which is, you know, all this volume is living on legacy platforms and moving to modern platforms like Marqeta.
And Jason, a lot of focus continues to be on Square with that $29 billion purchase of Afterpay. Square, from the numbers that I have seen, accounts for about 72 or 73% of your business. Does it make more sense for your company to be under that Square umbrella?
Well, Square is 73% of our business, as we said in the S-1. And what we've seen is they've adopted many different areas of our platform, both on the consumer side with Cash Card. We also power all of the ACH there. We also power the card on the Square Card side. We just recently announced that Square is using our checking solution on the merchant side. And we see, like, their success is our success. We're seeing them adopt many different areas of our platform. You talked about the acquisition of Afterpay, or the upcoming acquisition of Afterpay hasn't closed yet. But Afterpay is not a top five customer of Marqeta. They use a different part of the platform. But this shows the power of modern card issuing. This shows the ability for Marqeta to service many different facets of our customers. And we want Square to continue to grow and service them, obviously, into the future.
Fascinating time to be in this space. Marqeta founder and CEO Jason Garner, looking forward to staying in touch.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the time.
At the top of the hour, we got the latest downbeat data on consumer confidence, this time from the conference board that follows what we've heard from the University of Michigan last week. And joining us now to talk about the state of the consumer and what habits have changed, which haven't during the pandemic, let's bring in Katie Thomas, lead of the Kearney Consumer Institute. Katie, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. So let's just kind of start with how you guys in your data are seeing the state of the consumer, however you define that. You know, we've seen a lot of habits change, certainly, but we've seen a robust rebound in spending through most of the year, but it does seem to have leveled off a little bit. I'm curious, you know, if there's any data you guys are looking at that, you know, either supports or contrasts with some of that other economic data that's out there.
Absolutely. Thanks, Miles. So what we really decided to dig into as a result of the changing habits during the pandemic was the idea of consumer convenience and how that's frequently stated as a top priority now for consumers, as we've all ordered more online and gotten more familiar with technology. But after talking to consumers directly for our latest quarterly briefing, our Kearney Consumer Institute brief, we realized the way that we often discuss convenience, usually around speed and speed alone, is not how consumers are defining convenience. So we really deconstructed this concept and started to tease out instead the different trade-offs consumers are willing to make with their time. So in fact, if you think about all of us in the day-to-day, we're often willing to go out of our way or even be inconvenienced to go to the grocery store, you know, favorite snacks from Trader Joe's, I'll drive an extra 10 minutes. And even how we define convenience, in some cases, it's easier for some people to run into the store than to get delivery. And so these time trade-offs and these shifts in consumer behaviors really ladder up to a broader experience rather than being overly focused on the nitty gritty of speed in all aspects.
Katie, I think we've been talking so much today about Zoom's quarter and how its stocks is getting slammed, and it's clear that consumer behaviors are in fact changing, and they're willing to change them further as they go back to work or as they go back to school. I mean, do you think that focus on convenience and delivery, that will go away as people get back to a normal life, like get back to their 2019 lives?
Absolutely. I think you're seeing it already with the comp store sales numbers we saw with Q2, with Target, Walmart, Macy's. People were excited to get back into store, and that's exactly what we asked them, overall preference in-store versus delivery. We still saw in-store across the board, food, groceries, home decor, apparel. And so consumers really love that in-store experience, and they're willing to get back there. I mean, certainly with the confidence numbers, you're seeing some reticence around the Delta variant and a little bit of reluctance that we were starting to overcome. But in general, I think some of those convenience metrics were really due to forced closures and really high levels of concerns as opposed to permanent behavior changes.
You know, Katie, a company you guys highlighted in your report is StockX, about, kind of the frictions, the inherent frictions that are within that transaction. But I'm also curious just about, where they sit in consumer habits. You look at the streetwear market, the sneaker market, the watch market. Some of this is bleeding into NFTs now, I guess. But there's been this push into luxury and all this excess money has fed into goods. How has that changed maybe the landscape here for consumers as well, and maybe leads to more permanent changes after the pandemic?
Well, it's an interesting commentary, I think, on overall access. So the reason we highlighted StockX in our report was because consumers are willing to stretch to accommodate a transaction for limited edition sneakers and some of the other products that they sell. So they offset that by having a really strong differentiated offering and an interface that's super user friendly. I think in general, we've seen luxury have to think about how they're going to redefine themselves in terms of access as consumers are changing their behaviors in terms of resale, all of those different shifting dynamics there. But in general, there's still, people still want that exclusivity, and that still drives differentiation for consumers. So it's really about just figuring out what levers you can pull and how far a consumer is willing to be inconvenienced or kind of wait or spend more in order to accommodate a transaction.
All right, we'll leave it there. Katie Thomas, lead at the Kearney Consumer Institute. Katie, appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you so much.
U.S. military flights have ended, and our troops have departed Afghanistan. A new chapter of America's engagement with Afghanistan has begun. It's one in which we will lead with our diplomacy. The military mission is over. A new diplomatic mission has begun.
That was Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking last night, just hours after that last U.S. cargo plane took off from Kabul Airport. President Biden expected to address the end of America's longest war in a live address to the country later this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. To talk more about the future in the region, let's bring in Ian Bremmer. He is, of course, Eurasia Group President, as well as the G0 Media President. And Ian, it's always good to get your context on this, because I think there's a lot of people who are looking at this messy exit and then reflecting on the last 20 years, saying, what exactly did the U.S. accomplish here? What do you think the president needs to say today to mark the end of what is now America's longest war?
Well, he does need to say that he understood that this was going to be an enormously difficult decision. Losing a war on your watch, irrespective of how many presidents have been responsible for starting and continuing it, is never going to be fun. There are a lot of propaganda wins for his domestic opponents and his international opponents, and he has to lean into that. He has to own it. He's done that so far. He is going to have to, I think, do a better job of explaining both how he's made mistakes in execution of the evacuation and the ending on his watch, as well as continue to be 100% committed to getting the Americans and the Afghans who have special immigration visas to come to the United States. He needs to spell that out. But having said all of that, the last 2 weeks of relentless headline coverage on Afghanistan are going to end in all likelihood in fairly short order now that the vast majority of the Americans are out or leaving. And so, you know, I do think that part of what Biden is trying to do here is put a pin in the end of the war and move on to what he and most Americans consider to be far more important and impactful, like $3.5 trillion for infrastructure and supporting a frayed social contract.
We did hear Secretary Blinken say yesterday that this moment demands reflection. And he specifically said that we need to learn the lessons from Afghanistan and the lessons to shape how we think about fundamental questions about national security and foreign policy. What is that thinking, you think? What has shifted as a result of the way in which the U.S. exited Afghanistan, looking back on the last 20 years?
The one big lesson is that as rightfully angry and scared as Americans were after 9/11, we made Afghanistan into an almost existential threat to the American homeland. And it was never that. It was never a grade A national security priority for the U.S. It never merited 100,000+ servicemen and women on the ground fighting a war and rebuilding a nation. There were so many better things to be spending most of the $2 trillion+ that we have spent on this war over the course of the last 20 years. And there are plenty of people that can take responsibility and blame for that over the period of that time. We need to reflect on why it is that in an enormously divided United States, one of the very few foreign policies that Democrats, Republicans, and independents can agree on is get the hell out of Afghanistan. Even with a relatively limited footprint and less cost, and no American servicemen and women getting killed in fighting over the last year, didn't matter. They still wanted an end. Why? Why is it that a mission that the United States historically had a much easier time embracing, that of being the world's policeman, that of being the cheerleader of American values and open society and human rights, why doesn't that appeal to Americans anymore, irrespective of what part of the political spectrum you're on? And what does that mean for America's allies around the world? How should they think about the United States if we were in their shoes, something we need to be considering going forward?
There's, of course, the question about what the future relationship will be with the U.S. and Afghanistan. And we heard the Secretary say yesterday that the U.S. will engage with the Taliban, but will not do so in blind faith or trust. The U.N.'s already warned about a humanitarian disaster that is playing out within the country. What do you think the U.S. relationship will be like with Afghanistan? What should it be? How does the U.S. see its role in the region?
It's obviously going to be a lot less important and impactful than the countries in the region who have a lot more at stake in what happens in Afghanistan going forward. And those countries are, in no particular order, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, and China. That's a rogues gallery of governments that we don't get on with and we don't trust, never mind the Taliban themselves. So having said all of that, we do have shared interests with all of those countries on a few basic issues around the future of Afghanistan. Number one, we want the government to maintain coherent and not fall apart into civil war. Number two, we'd like sufficient security so you don't see a humanitarian crisis with millions of refugees streaming out of the country. Number three, we don't want Afghanistan to be a home for a power vacuum and radical Islamic terror that will not just threaten Afghans, but will also threaten people in countries all over the world. We share those fundamental interests with Pakistan, with China, with Russia, and with Iran. And so I thought it was very interesting and useful that the Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi came out just a couple of days ago and called for an emergency G20 summit on Afghanistan going forward. Now, that's not the G7. That's not the democracies that we get along with pretty well and trust, even if that's trade. That's the broader constellation of countries in the world that include those that really do have Afghanistan in their backyard. We're going to need to find ways to engage with them. What the Americans decide about Afghanistan going forward is not going to fundamentally determine the future of that country. It's kind of like what happens with Syria after Obama gave up on the red line. It wasn't about the United States anymore. That's the point.
What's interesting when you think about the president's commitment, if you want to call it that, he was very adamant about withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, in part, some would argue, because he wanted to focus on bigger foreign policy issues like China. China clearly sees a big opportunity within Afghanistan, not just with its natural resources, but also to really expand its Belt and Road Initiative. And I know we're still talking about the early days, but what do you see as China's role within the country? And how big of an opportunity is there really?
I want to say I disagree with that. I think that China sees a propaganda opportunity in rubbing America's nose in the fact that there's all these horrible videos coming out of Afghanistan and the Taliban sees that they've won. But this is not a real opportunity for China. It's a problem for China. China now has to deal with, the fact that they've got a deeply unstable and pretty radical government right on their border. Belt and Road investment from China has been decreasing over the last several years. China has their own domestic priorities that are much more important in terms of what they want to spend their money on. And the investments they've already made in Afghanistan, in copper mines, for example, and other heavy infrastructure, have not paid off well. They've been incredibly difficult to bring into effect because there ain't no infrastructure in one of the most geographically remote parts of the world. That's only going to get harder under the Taliban. So, I mean, I have to say, if China had a free media, and they don't have anything remotely close to it, you'd see over the next few years Afghanistan making more headlines in China as it's making less headlines in the United States. That's not a good thing. If Afghanistan's making headlines in your country, you're probably screwing something up. That's a pretty good rule of thumb.
Finally, Ian, how do you think this is going to play domestically here in the U.S.? You sort of alluded to the fact that, look, there's been so much attention on this with all the headlines coming out of Afghanistan over the last few weeks. Clearly, that has hurt President Biden. There's a lot of Republicans who are looking at this saying, you know, maybe this could be an issue come midterms. Do you think it's going to stick?
Heck, there are Democrats that are saying that. Biden's taken a lot of hits from his own party in how he's communicated here. I don't think the level of attention that we've had for the last couple of weeks is likely to persist. I mean, barring something truly cataclysmic with the remaining American citizens that are on the ground. But I do think that this is going to be an issue in the midterm elections, precisely because Biden won as the adult who tells us the truth, who is capable on these international issues, who's been on the Foreign Relations Committee for decades in the Senate. And frankly, there are just a bunch of things over the last month that President Biden, that Secretary of State Blinken, and others have said about Afghanistan that just have not been true. And they had to contradict themselves and didn't take responsibility, in my view, when the Taliban suddenly took over all of Afghanistan within a few days and when Kabul fell. And I think that those sound bites are going to be replayed over and over. This is a bigger deal than Benghazi was for Obama, for Hillary Clinton. And in a very divided United States, of course, you know, the Republicans are going to run with that. I do think that come midterm elections, some seats will probably be lost on the basis of what is seen as a debacle in Afghanistan, even though the responsibility for the war in Afghanistan is overwhelmingly not that of President Biden.
It certainly feels that way right now, but we're going to be watching to see the lasting impact. Ian Bremmer, it's always good to talk to you. Really appreciate the time joining us from Eurasia Group. He's, of course, the president there and the president of G0 Media.
Well, Welcome back. There is a new bourbon brand in town, and chances are you're going to recognize the co-founders, actors Ian Somerhalder and Paul Wesley. Yep, they've gone from being brothers on the popular CW show Vampire Diaries to launching the Brothers Bond Bourbon. And we are so delighted to have them here with us now. Guys, thanks so much for being with us. You got your bottle. You're ready to go. Look, congratulations. I know when this bourbon launched in May, you started selling it online, and it sold out within days. Ian, I'm going to toss this one to you. What was the inspiration for doing this with your friend Paul?
You know, this is over 10 years in the making. This guy and I spent so many hundreds, well, thousands and thousands of hours on a set together. And this is the most authentic thing that we could think of doing. You know, this is our soul is in this bottle. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a product that this uncompromising quality with this level of IP built into the product. So we're really, really grateful and humbled.
Paul, what was it like building this bourbon brand from the ground up, especially during a pandemic? How'd you guys do it?
You know, I mean, in first of all, we've been talking about doing this for 10 years and we built this for the last few years. But I have to say, in a way, I mean, obviously it was a horrible time. But at the same time, it forced us to sit in our homes, get on our Zooms, talk every single day and develop this product. Ian and I live close to one another. So I went to Ian's. We blended this bourbon together in his living room
for over a year.
For over a year. We created this, we created the label, we came up with the name. So everything we did, we had obviously a lot of time on our hands. So in a way, it was serendipitous. I hate to say that, but in a way, it sort of worked out to our favor. And it was such a beautiful passion project. And here we are on Yahoo Finance talking about it. And we're just so humbled and thrilled to be here.
And we just announced a huge announcement 48 hours ago, 50,000 cases sold in the first 4 months after launch is pretty substantial. And we're just super humbled and really grateful to everyone.
That is crazy good. What's the price point? What's it selling for?
$39.99.
Okay, that's pretty reasonable. And I love the bottle. I love the look of it. We were talking during the break. I think I'm going to open up my bottle over the holiday weekend. Talk to us about the label. It's a tree with, is it the two of you sitting under the tree?
Yeah, we always argue who's who, but yeah, right. That's me and that's Ian.
Yeah, it's better angle of Paul.
That's right. It's not right side. Better. No, but this it's go ahead and an arbitrary label.
No, I mean, yeah. It's super symbolic, obviously, right? The Brothers Bond is the anchor that holds this big, you know, organic of structure in between the boys. They have the ability to be safe and look out and have perspective. These are the grains actually built in, you know, the corn, wheat, barley, and rye built into the tree. And the birds signify and nature and freedom.
And the tree is an oak tree. And as we all know, bourbon is aged in oak barrels. Yep. So yeah. Everything has a meaning and a significance.
Yeah, new American oak. And so every bit of it, like Paul said, has significance. It's very, very organic. And it feels to us that sort of sense of like, nostalgia, solid, you know, purity
and bonding, togetherness,
bonding and inspiration, because nature and each, you know, nature inspires us and protects us as do you inspire me and protect me.
Thanks, buddy.
No, it's really special.
You guys, that is awesome. Thanks for the show and tell and for explaining the label for us. So look, it's no surprise to you. There are lots of celebrity backed brands out there of spirits, of alcohol. You know, how do you distinguish yourself and get seen and, you know, build on what you're having right now, the success, and not just sort of be like a flash in the pan?
Well, yeah, Ian loves to call himself a celebrity.
First of all, let me set it right straight. We do everything in our power not to call one another or refer to ourselves as celebrities.
But I'll just say really quickly, and then I'll hand it off to Ian. But, you know, every single thing, you know, as you said, there's a lot of celebrity brands out there. Most people, and I'm not saying specific names or anything, but most people will slap their names on a bottle and, you know, sell a product that they really had no part in developing. Everything you see here, from the label to the name to the mash bill inside to the bottle, was designed by Ian and myself and our team. And so for us, this is extremely organic. Also, for those of you who don't know, Ian and I were on a show called The Vampire Diaries. We played brothers. We drank bourbon on the show. Ian and I drank bourbon off screen when we finished work. We fell in love with bourbon. We shot it in the South, the show in the South. And so, you know, this is extremely organic to us. And it's just, it's something that just makes perfect sense.
It's also, too, about the ethos of this company is about bringing people together, right? And I think we can all sort of agree that we need togetherness ultimately more now than ever in history. And Brothers Bond is the company to do that. We encourage a deep sense of community and belonging. It's inclusive, not exclusive.
And you want to mention the agriculture?
Yeah, 100%. Like, listen, we all know that there a give back component, particularly up and down the supply chain of any new company coming into the fold, is absolutely necessary. The future of business are the companies with triple bottom lines: people, planet, profit. End of story, right? So we're giving back to regenerative agriculture. We obviously know scientifically regenerative agriculture can stop climate change in its tracks, put it in our rearview mirror. So we are doubling down and putting our money where our mouth is, not just as a company, but as individuals, and encouraging our partners and our families. I mean, this is what we do. We are an agriculture company, and we are going to make sure that we invest heavily in regenerative ag by sequestering enormous amounts of carbon dioxide and storing it safely back in the ground where it belongs.
Well, we like that component of the whole situation here. Spoken like true, you know, co-founders and CEOs, Ian Somerhalder, Paul Wesley. Thanks so much, guys, and best of luck with the bourbon.
There's no way I would be – our CEO, Vincent Hanna, runs the company. There's no way I would trust either one of us to be CEOs of this company.
That's right.
Hey,
well, you got the lingo down.
Right, guys. Enjoy. Thank you for this, Yahoo. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
enjoy the bourbon. Enjoy your long holiday weekend.
All right, underperform rating, $6 price target. That is what Macquarie analyst Chad Bynum is thinking about shares of AMC right now. In a recent note, looking at the overall movie industry, let's bring in Chad right now to talk more about this call. So, Chad, let's just start with the vision that you guys have for AMC right now and the fundamental kind of backdrop that you are analyzing AMC against and how you're getting to $6 a share.
Thank you. And thank you for mentioning the fundamental case here. So fundamentally, we had been calling for the box office in the United States to recover back to pre-pandemic levels, really at the beginning of 2023. And we thought that 2022 would only be down mid to high single digits. We've recently become a little bit more negative in terms of the pace of the recovery. So for this year, we're expecting the third quarter to be down 50%. Fourth quarter down 35%, next year down around 15%. And then in 2023 versus pre-pandemic, we still expect for box office admissions to be down 8%. And what the companies are doing to combat that negative admission trend is they're actually seeing really good trends in terms of pricing on ticket price and on concession sales. But for companies like AMC, we think they're going to get hit with the same inflationary pressures that others are seeing in the industry. We just don't think there's a fundamental picture. We have them losing money in 2022. And then from our valuation standpoint, we're looking at 2023 free cash to arrive to our $6 target.
And, you know, Chad, in the last segment, we were just looking at a couple of major releases from Paramount getting pushed back, you know, another 6 months or more, depending on the exact film. I mean, is there still perhaps in thinking about the movie business, you look at what's happening with the way HBO Max is treating some films, Disney Plus is treating some film, Paramount Plus might be treating films differently. Is there still not really, let's call it a floor on what the box office baseline looks like on the other side of this? Because we are benchmarking to incredibly strong years for the industry, 17, 18, 19. And I do wonder if we're still not rationalizing what a normal, quote unquote, normal box office looks like, you know, 4 or 5 years out.
That's exactly our thinking. Look, I think most studios do believe that they'll get back closer to this 45-day window at the box office instead of the day and date. Movies that have been released at the box office and simultaneously at the home have not done very well during the past couple of weeks. Movies that have a 45-day window have done a little bit better, but still not back to what we were seeing before. And then we look at, you know, trends that we're seeing at malls, theme parks, casinos, travel. You know, so many sectors are back to pre-pandemic levels. And the fact that admission revenues in the United States are still 50% of what they were. Now, I understand, you know, kids aren't vaccinated, so a lot of those G and PG movies aren't seeing much attendance, but still for a good movie with PG-13 or R-rated, we're just not seeing the demand that we were seeing before.
Chad, hang with me on this one. So I was a one-time stock analyst, covered retailers, many retailers for many years. I made some aggressive calls, but I never got a response the similar responses that I'm getting when I tweeted out your note from AMC. There's a very passionate group of people here, I would say retail investors following AMC. As an analyst, what is it like right now to cover this company? Are you getting emails from really AMC believers? Do you get notes written to your house? Like, how difficult is to do what you're doing here?
Thank you for that. Yeah, it has been a pretty difficult time. I think, the AMC story is really momentum and technically driven. And a lot of the leaders of this following have highlighted that this is a really good time from a technical standpoint. And a lot of people are calling for a breakout. And, some believe that the stock can get to 100. Some believe it can get to 100,000. It has outperformed other meme stocks, and it sounds like there has been some consolidation. However, we do think after Labor Day, when some of these investors are back at work and maybe, they're looking at other things, maybe they're gambling on sports, which will be on this weekend and next weekend, maybe the bloom comes off the rose a little bit. But yeah, certainly there has been a lot of negative feedback. A lot of people just kind of go back and say the fundamentals don't matter. But, we think they still do. And we think at some point, the meme stock rally or the technical, factors that everyone loves about AMC might become more attractive on other names. So when that happens, that's when we think, a lot of the AMC investors could move into another name that they find more attractive. And then the fundamentals will matter.
And then, Chad, just finally, just to close the loop on this note, I mean, you guys are out with an outperform on IMAX and on Cinemark. So there are names in the movie business that you like. What are those two chains doing differently that gives them a little more visibility to some stronger performance here, as the industry recovers, but perhaps as we've been discussing at a different pace than maybe some had hoped?
Yeah, so we really like IMAX. IMAX is a global company. About a third of their business comes in China, a third rest of the world, and a third domestically. The 45-day window doesn't hurt them as much because movies in an IMAX screen are generally there for 1, maybe 2 weeks max. Secondly, they get paid on the projectors that they place into AMC theaters and Regal theaters and Cinemark theaters. And they have a huge backlog that should be monetized over the next 24 months. So that's money that's just kind of an inventory right now that they will receive. They have a clean balance sheet as well, and the valuation is cheaper than what we've seen over the last couple of years. For Cinemark, more of a traditional exhibitor, similar to AMC or Regal, they historically have just generated significantly higher margins. So margins of 20 to 25% versus AMC, which is 10 to 15%. Rent less than their screens as a percentage of total revenues. We think they're just in better markets. They have good growth, and they also have a great balance sheet. So I'd say it's balance sheet, operations, and really, just kind of a catalyst going forward. Cinemark also was the leader in terms of dividend paying. They had a really good payout ratio. I think they can get back to that, and that'll start in 2022.
All right. We'll leave it there. Always appreciate the time, Chad Bynum with Macquarie. Chad, I know we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
The pandemic has generally lifted the financial fortunes of many players in the fast food industry. Households have gravitated to eating more at home and have favored the contactless experience of drive-thrus. Let's check in to see how Checkers Drive-In Restaurants is faring right now. Francis Allen is president and CEO and joins us now. Francis, good to see you here this morning. Look, you are primarily a drive-through oriented business. You have the outdoor seating. So that is, I suspect, been a tailwind to your business. How are sales right now?
We're doing very well. Q2 on a two-year basis, we were up 17.8% versus 2019. So, we had a very strong 2020. We outperformed the competition by 600 basis points, and it's looking good in 21 so far.
And Francis, thinking about some of those trends, you know, we've talked to a lot of folks with the amount of exposure to consumers that certainly you guys are going to have. How do you view the state of the consumer today? We've seen some of the stimulus start to expire. We know consumers are sitting, you know, on a lot of savings. Does the sell-through today indicate to you guys that there is still, you know, kind of a strong demand out there across the board from folks?
Look, we definitely see an uptick when those child tax credits go out each month, and certainly the stimulus earlier in the year. I think that we are a brand that is all about craveable food, affordable and affordable food. So we've seen a kind of continuous demand for our product. We also had already, prior to the pandemic, lent into delivery. And we saw our delivery business double. So I think we've got a lot of new customers coming in. We estimate about 50% of the people that have tried us on delivery are new customers to the brand, which is fantastic. We also have a double drive-through. So we were able to convert many of our drive-through lanes to be dedicated delivery lanes. So that actually creates a much better guest experience and a much better experience, importantly, for the drivers.
Francis,
in addition to that...
Oh, go ahead.
As I'm saying, in addition to that, we launched a loyalty app in January that has an order ahead feature. So and we're seeing good uptick of that as well.
I was just going to say, Francis, that checkers behind you in your background, that does not look like the one by me in Long Island, New York. Yeah. Have you come out with a new concept and a redesign?
Yes. This is our new restaurant of the future. We are very excited about it. A lot of work has gone into both what the guest experience, but also the employee experience. So within this new design is a brand new kitchen, which makes it much easier for our crew, which is critically important right now. We all know what's going on with labor. But we have newly designed kitchens, way more efficient. I mean, one of the things that we found, for example, is that the way that our equipment was all laid out and the way that the menu had changed over the years, our crew were walking an extra mile and a half collectively every hour than was really necessary. So imagine the productivity of rejigging that equipment and the benefit to employees. Also equipment that is much easier to train on. So from the guest experience, they're going to get hotter food served faster and more craveable food. And from this new iconic look, from an employee experience, way easier to use, easier to learn, and pleasant to be in.
And Francis, on the labor topic, I think Bojangles has really set off a discussion in the fast food industry, giving workers a week off to rest up, but they're not paying them. Is that something you're looking at doing just to give employees just a breather because it has been so busy over the past year and a half?
Well, I would be very remiss at this point not to thank our entire team for their tireless efforts. I mean, it has been a long 18 months for our crew, and we could not be more grateful to them. They're really dedicated people. They show up every day and do a great job. So we're incredibly grateful. We're seeing the labor challenges. We are doing all kinds of things to show our appreciation. We've raised wages like most people. We closed our stores on July 4th because we just wanted to make sure that everybody actually got a day off to celebrate with their families. We believe that people should work when they want to work. So we're giving everybody, obviously, the opportunity to do that. We're one of the first chains to also launch instant pay, which means that if a team member or a manager works, sorry, a shift manager works one day, they get paid the next. And that's been a huge benefit for us.
That's interesting. I can't recall hearing that elsewhere in the fast food industry, Francis. So if I were to work at a Checkers right now, let's say a cook in the kitchen, how much would I make per hour?
Our average average wage is just over $11 an hour right now. That's obviously a blended rate across the country. We've seen some markets where the wage inflation has gone up by 10-15%. Other markets, not so much. So it really depends on the supply and demand in the marketplace.
All right, we'll leave it there. Francis Allen, President and CEO of Checkers Drive-In Restaurants. Good to see you. Big fan of your fries. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Brian.